For our COBT viewers and listeners, it's Maynard, Mike, and Todd here with something exceptional for this COBT. We're talking with the team at Mobius. In particular, we've got Matt Parker. He's a managing director in the strategy area at Mobius. And we've also got Alex Melvin. He's a commodity risk analyst with the firm. If you don't know Mobius, you should. It's a really interesting firm. It's a risk advisory firm that helps producers, consumers, really anyone exposed to the commodity world in any context. And they help you manage that risk. And as they like to say, they help you turn that risk into an asset. But they're good friends. We've known them for a long time. Matt, Alex, really appreciate you guys coming on the show today and talking about the world we're living in. It's pretty risky.
Pleasure to be here with you.
All right. Well, Mike and Todd, before we jump in and manage some risk with Matt and Alex, what would you guys tell us that's on your mind today?
Yeah, Maynard, just really kind of four things up front real quick. I mean, from an economic standpoint, obviously, interest rates are in the news. You had the 10-year up to around 4.65%. Hot retail sales on Monday. The market's going to be looking at initial jobless claims on Thursday. And so, you know, that's going to create some volatility in markets. From a commodity standpoint, I think the surprise of the markets this week is that this Israeli-Iran conflict, that crude oil didn't move, doesn't surprise us that much. I mean, it had been very well advertised for days and days and days. And so it didn't really follow through. And it just kind of, if you recall a week or two ago, we said we're getting a little bit less constructive on crude oil just from a trading standpoint, just because it looked like it was becoming very consensus that crude was going to keep going higher. We still think the second half 24 demand setup looks really good for crude oil. And so we think crude kind of, you know, hangs in here, and we'll see what the conflict brings, but not too surprised what happened there. You know, I'd say from a broader equity market standpoint, the markets are looking at really three things. One, obviously, the direction of interest rates. Two, what happens with this Mideast conflict. But three is we're like really starting earnings seasons right now. You've had a couple of these bank companies report less than expected earnings. So I think what's going to happen here is volatility is going to be high. Earnings are going to be extremely important because markets, even though they're not oversold now, right now, but they're near all-time highs. And so there's going to be increased volatility. From the energy sector standpoint, we're just starting to get into earnings seasons. This is going to be this week. You're going to have Liberty and Kinder Morgan. Actually, they're going to report tonight at the close. And, SLB they're going to report on Friday. And so what we're going to hear from Liberty is we're going to get the first read on what pressure pumping trends look like, what guidance they're going to be giving for pressure pumping into 2024. And Schlumberger or Slavis and, SLB, as we like to call it. We're going to obviously be getting, what it looks like from an offshore standpoint, what international markets look like. I mean, those are still going to be strong. My guess is they're going to, paint a really good story. So that's really kind of a wrap of what we're looking at right now in the markets.
Okay, great. Todd, what would you throw in the hat before we get started with the guys?
Well, I just have a short little note. We were reading some of Mobius's recent pieces, and one that caught my eye was some statistics about how much coal generation is being added globally, in particular by China and India and Indonesia. And it got me curious, to compare that amount of coal generation with the amount of renewables that have been developed in the United States. And just, is it a 1-to-1? Is it a 0.5-to-1? I didn't know. So to give everybody some perspective, last year globally, we added net around 50 gigawatts of coal capacity. There was something like 70 added and then 20 of retirements. In the U.S., by comparison, we added, according to the EIA, about 30 gigawatts of solar and wind. So what that says is for every 1 megawatt of new renewable we add in the U.S., the rest of the world is adding about 1.5 megawatts of coal generation. And when you just think through the implications of that, my sense is that coal generation is probably going to run with a lot higher capacity factor than the gas or than the solar and the wind in the United States is going to add. It's just interesting. We're going to talk, I think, today about the interrelationships amongst the various commodities and power. And we might touch on the LNG pause, but the guys talk about this in their piece. If you're somewhere else in the world and you need reliable baseload power and we're messing around with our regulatory framework, sometimes it's hard to count on things and you say, I'm just going to build coal. There was also a piece in Bloomberg today about the same thing. I just think it's interesting to think through what the rest of the world is doing versus what kind of the OECD, in particular the United States and Western Europe, is doing.
Yeah, that's a great point, Todd, because I think, as you say, you could just do basic amount of coal, basic amount of renewables, but when you factor in they're building theirs a lot faster, and then you lower the capacity factor on the renewables, the pace at which coal is being added relative to renewables, pretty impressive. Well, that there you see it. The Mobius guys always have good tidbits like that to talk about. And in particular, guys, you really got our attention. Last week, we were all talking about the eclipse, and you quite smartly put out a piece saying, here's what power prices did during the eclipse. And by the way, we knew it was coming. That's the kind of good thinking that's going on over there at Mobius. Matt, maybe I'll just turn to you. I mentioned the managing director and strategy. Tell us a little bit about big picture, what's happening at Mobius. Maybe give people a feel for the firm, the types of things you're dealing with, thinking about, et cetera. I'd love just to give folks a sense of all the things that Mobius is doing.
Yeah, thanks, Maynard. We do financial hedge strategy for large, very large, and some very small E&Ps. Also, financial hedge strategy in the consumer space, mostly around natural gas. We also specialize in physical marketing strategy and all the way down to actual physical marketing and scheduling and accounting. So sort of a full suite of a marketing department for the physical gas and physical oil side. My focus is on the strategic side, mostly of financial hedging for producers and consumers and coming up with physical infrastructure solutions that can achieve those same kind of financial risk mitigations for producers and consumers as well. In order to do that, we do a lot of fundamental research and we do a lot of analytics on what's available, and especially in the derivative hedge space for efficient hedges. Do a lot of research on the term structure and what kinds of hedges have worked out over time. You know, I think what as far as what our clients are worried about right now and what we're seeing right now, it's been, you know, in the natural gas space, this sleeping giant was awoken sometime in 2018 or 2019 when we realized when the LNG really started to come and volatility reared its head, and we realized we don't have enough storage capacity, we don't have enough pipeline capacity. And so anytime it gets cold or anytime it gets too hot in the summer, there's going to be extreme volatility. And so we've been dealing with that, you know, for the last 6 years now, especially in the last 2 years. And I think it's made the space, it's made it much more interesting from a speculator's point of view. It's made it much more dangerous, both for producers and consumers. And so we specialize in developing solutions to mitigate those kinds of that kind of volatility.
So Matt, could I just ask you, because I think this is a theme that, as you say, we've had it in recent years. And as you look out, volatility around prices and power prices and commodity prices and just and different delivery points, all these types of things. Is there a way, when we talk about how volatile the market, like that comment you just made, since 2018, is there a quick metric you have that you could share that just illustrates how much more volatile it is today in today's world than it was, you know, 6 years ago?
I don't have the exact implied volatility figures in front of me, but, you know, pre 2018, we had settled back down into a kind of 30% implied volatility market, somewhere in there for natural gas, which is closer to what crude normally does. And then as we went through the 2022 period and traded back up to $8, $9, $10, we're looking at a 70 to even 100% implied volatility, which is quite extraordinary, and resembles some of those huge volatility spikes in the past in natural gas. If you think about things like Hurricane Katrina or the cold snap of 2000, 2001, or the 2013, 2014 era. So, you know, almost record high volatility. And not only that, the volatility of the call options in particular, I think set record highs in 2022, just showing how much fear there was that this market not only could go to $10 or $20 or $30, but to $50, with European prices trading at $100, obviously. So, much more volatile, much more dynamic, not only in terms of just the volatility of the front of the market, but the spreads between the summers and the winters have reawoken and are kind of back into the territory they were in again, back in the kind of Katrina pre-shale era.
So Matt, you mentioned, I think you said speculators. I think what those of us on the outside of the commodity markets always wonder about is, you know, what percent of the activity is taking place by people who are speculators versus either producers or consumers. Does today's market have more just financial activity trading it? Is that a percent that is up in all this volatility? You would maybe think so.
Well, I think in terms of just for right now, in the commitment of traders reports, you have very high longs and high shorts in natural gas. I think there's a lot of bets both ways right now. Looking back historically, you know, since the year 2000, I don't think the liquidity and degree of interest and ability for speculators to hold risk in the back of the curve is still back to what it was in the kind of Enron mid 2000s time period. I don't think the banks are obviously a much bigger player, and you have the era of the great big hedge funds and merchants with big risk desks is gone, but they're not willing to hold as much risk, and so it makes it a more you know, a less liquid market from that perspective.
So I should have mentioned this up front. I think one thing that's interesting about your business model is if someone, and I alluded to it, but if someone's looking to sell forward or buy forward or just kind of manage around what they perceive to be their physical risk, you know, you're an agent for them in that. You don't execute the hedge, but I've always thought that's an interesting business model. I don't know. You might elaborate on that a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, we do kind of all flavors of that. We'll just purely consult with someone. We will act as agent and execute the hedge between usually a bilateral hedge between, let's say, a producer and a bank. Or we'll sit alongside them as they do that. I know the real value of what we do, I think, is on the that's valuable. I think execution, you can make a lot of mistakes. There's a lot of control things there. And there are a few pennies here and there you can pick up. You know, not getting run over by a sales desk. But the real value is, I think, you know, having a plan, looking forward. What are we going to do if we go into steep contango? What are we going to do if we go steeply backward? What do we do if gas on the East Coast, you know, basis gets cheap, or on the West Coast? You know, are we going to use that as a time to wait for the market to come to us and hedge? And so I think the most important thing is having a plan and understanding why you have that plan and having the data behind it to back it up. This is a good time to buy. This is a good price level to buy. This is with our strategy. This helps us meet our objectives. And that's really what we spend our time on with our clients.
And Matt, LNG's obviously exploded, you know, over the last 6 years or so. Just the growth in global LNG markets, that obviously creates some noise here in the markets in the U.S., but how has the growth of global LNG, how does that show up at Mobius?
Well, you know, the arb, as we say, is wide open between the Gulf Coast and everywhere, and so it just feels like it's an open pipeline heading out. And so the way we felt the summer of COVID, you know, the arb closed, so to speak, and so we've had some gas backing up in the U.S. No one expected that to happen, and I think it took something like COVID for that to happen, and we don't expect it to happen again with all this Russian gas off, but you know, inventories are full in Europe, but it wasn't a problem last year. From what I think the most interesting thing about LNG and the 15 BCF a day we have to put into, you know, the liquefaction plants to get out the 12 BCF of exports is that it ties us directly to Europe on the curtailment curtailing that supply to the upside. So for example, you know, when Europe is trading $100, and if we're going to run out of gas, the switch we have is to go to $100 and turn off our gas going to Europe, right? And so when that switch gets very high, like it did in the summer of 2022, you know, we have to price in the odds that we're going to have to turn off our gas in the winter. And that's really what we did in 2022. It's not that everyone thought we needed to average $12 in the summer of 2022, in the winter of 2022 to make it. It's that there was a 1 in 10 chance that it was cold enough that we had to price our gas over $100. And so kind of think about adding $10 premium to the market in a very simplistic way. And so when you have that much disparity, you know, $5 to $100. Now, it's not $100 anymore. It's only 10. So it's nowhere near the problem it was in the past. But that's why, that's what adds the volatility to the upside. Whereas before, that volatility wasn't there because we were kind of oversupplied and had enough storage capacity. So to me, that's the really interesting thing. And I think that that's what people misunderstand. Even when we're not trading 100, you know, the winner now is trading, let's say $4. It's trying to price in the odds that it's cold. If it's not cold, it's not going to be $4. And it's the same with every basis location around the country. And it's kind of unique to natural gas because it's so dependent on the weather. But I think that's one thing that when you do see the big premiums in the wintertime and you do see the premiums, you know, getting into the summer, that's a good time for producers to take advantage of it. Because their odds are we're not going to go there. There's a 10% chance we're going to go higher than there, but you need to take advantage of that kind of risk premium when it's there, just to a certain extent.
So I was just struck by one, Matt, as you were talking, which is, so if you're a producer, let's say, you know, right now, and you're looking ahead to the winter of next year, or just generally thinking about hedging next year, is there your experience when, if I'm a producer and I call five banks, that what they might offer me in terms of a forward sale is going to be pretty different? Like, because you would think it's a efficient market and everybody's going to have the same price, but how different do the bids tend to be when you make those phone calls, if you will?
I mean, I think it's just a matter of their risk appetite at the moment. You know, okay, there may be some smaller regional banks. They're just never a good bid, let's say, because they have to pass it so much of it through to a bigger bank. And so they kind of have to be outside of their two-way. But I think it more depends on whether or not they want that risk in their book and what they want to do with it.
I see.
You know, in general. I mean, if you think about the bulge bracket banks, sometimes they're better than the other ones. And I think it's a matter of their risk preference rather than, you know, trying to scalp you or not being good at their jobs.
Well, Alex, as we turn to Mike and Todd, I mentioned it up front, you're a commodity risk analyst. As I understand it, you really champion a lot of the analytics that are outward bound, where you're sharing thoughts with people, like the one you did on what happened to power prices during the solar eclipse, which was very clever and in a way so obvious, but it felt like none of us were talking about it. How did you jump on that issue, and what's been the feedback from your report there?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having us. You know, honored to be a part of this, big fan of the show. So it's cool to be able to chat with you guys. As for the ERCOT eclipse situation, that was something that, you know, we're paying attention to the larger utility scale challenges for grid operators when they're trying to accommodate all of these new renewables that are coming on that have this inherent volatility. And so that was kind of the perfect opportunity right there to say, hey, we have this thing that we know is coming for, you know, years ahead, but let's just say months, for a grid planner, for, you know, all these different elements that need to come together. And I want to see what is going to happen to power prices. Are they going to be able to say, we're going to keep this under $101 megawatt hour, like they say? And so, you know, ultimately we can dive into that, but the high level is that they didn't. They spiked to $471 megawatt hour. And I think it's kind of the perfect microcosm for this larger discussion that I think needs to be a little bit more open.
Alex, so that, if you don't mind, we'll attach that report you guys did to this blast. It's really quite interesting. But that $471 a megawatt hour, just to give people a feel for it, what would be the, you know, typical?
Yeah, I'll throw a chart up right now and show kind of the price history for ERCOT over the last 10-ish years. Yeah, so I think this really hits home to what Matt was kind of touching on there, where, you know, the 2015 to 2018, 2019 shale era, we have quite muted electricity prices for consumers and kind of all across ERCOT system-wide prices. When we start to see, one, the addition of renewables and larger capacities, if you plot the trend line of renewable installations, wind and solar, next to this, it closely matches, you know, it closely matches this spike that we start to see, where we're getting prices over $1,000 a megawatt hour. These are real-time daily prices, daily average prices. And we're starting to see quite a bit of volatility coming in here, where, you know, our typical is going to be somewhere around, you know, $10 to $20 a megawatt hour, maybe up to $100 a megawatt hour at peak demand, with adequate resource planning. But when we have these hour to hour, day to day variabilities and wind output, solar output, that's presenting a real challenge for ERCOT. And you see MISO up in the Midwest saying the same thing. And that was highlighted in NERC's report last December. We have another piece on that on the Insights tab. But I think it's really an interesting conversation that I think should be one, policy driven, but also strategically, how are we going to accommodate this variability for natural gas producers, for storage systems that are underinvested, and all these different elements that come together to create a stable, stable grid environment for economic activity.
Well, Mike, let's turn to you. I'll make a lead-in comment. Our if this was a weather report with first Matt and then Alex, we've got volatility with an outlook for more volatility is what it feels like we're saying here. But Mike, let me turn it to you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt and Alex. Glad you guys are on our show. It's you guys put out some really interesting stuff. You know, one of the questions you talked about earlier, Matt, is natural gas storage. And, you know, referencing one of your pieces, you talked about over the last 15 years, you know, U.S. natural gas production has grown 90% to roughly 103, 104 BCF a day. We're now around 99 BCF a day because shut-ins. But you also talked about, you know, storage has only grown around 10% to roughly 25 BCF a day. And so I guess my question is when we listen to, you know, to midstream pipeline calls, they're selectively buying stuff, but they're really not building this stuff. And so when I ask you is, what does it take from an economic standpoint? What does it take from a pricing standpoint? Maybe what does it take from an implied volatility standpoint for more of this stuff to be built? Just some thoughts there.
Yeah, you know, we went through this, you know, one time before in the early 2000s when power demand from gas started to grow, and we built a lot of combined cycle turbines, and gas demand all of a sudden was too big for the system. And so we had, you know, let's call it around 3.4 TCF of storage available, something like that, 3.5 maybe. And then within a very short period of time after leading up to Katrina and after Katrina, we built another 400 or 500 BCF of storage capacity. A lot of it's the high turn salt. Storage capacity, which is the most valuable kind that can really bail out the system in a cold snap, because it can refill quickly over a weekend, for example, as it did in 2013-14. And so what that took back then was spreads between the summer and the winter of between $1 and $2 between, let's say, October to January. And then so then you have the backside of that as well, the January down to April, also, you know, $1 or $2. So you have to put the premium really in the winter to incentivize someone to build a storage facility where they fill it up in the summer and take it out in the winter. One thing we're seeing this time around that we didn't see so much last time around is every basis location in the U.S. on top of the NYMEX having a dollar of spread between October and January, let's say, that might have between 50 cents and a dollar or $2 or more. Now you can imagine in California and on the East Coast, it's quite large, but it's to no avail because they're not going to build any storage out there. And they're not going to build any pipelines to those people either, right? And so we think of it as like these two islands on the east side of the Appalachian Trail and on the west side of the Rocky Mountains that they basically made themselves like Europe. And they're on a different path than we are here in the middle of the country. And every time, you know, they're the ones who are susceptible to global pricing, much more so than we are in the rest of the country. And that puts them at a real, you know, they over time, I would expect them to deindustrialize. I'd expect all that stuff to move places where energy is cheap and away from places where it's expensive. And we'll see it. And we'll see how that works out. I mean, historically, those have been some of the most, especially in the Northeast, like pretty resilient. There's a lot of infrastructure up there. There's a lot of redundancy in generation because it gets cold there, and they're very worried about the lights going out. They don't seem as worried about that anymore. But, you know, it just takes, I think we just get complacent, you know, like in Texas in February of 20, when Uri came, it just hadn't been cold in February for 15 years. And so ERCOT's like, yeah, let's do a bunch of maintenance. Let's like, you know, whatever, don't weatherize anything, you know? And I think if we had not had that view, that probably wouldn't have happened. I mean, it was a pretty extreme event, but a lot of it was just complacency. And that's what we see in the energy markets time and time again. You know, three warm winters, like, oh, it can never go high again. Sell it all, you know? I think everyone sees this volatility and this issue, even though we're oversupplied right now temporarily. I think everyone's aware that there's a big problem.
Matt, what you just said, there was a handful of comments there that were so potent, right? Like you said, the East and the West Coast have kind of made themselves like Europe. The East and the West Coast, they're not going to build pipelines. They're not going to build storage. And then you said the East and the West Coast are going to experience deindustrialization because anyone who's a big energy user in those places is going to say, I got to get to a safety zone, like the inner of the country. Yeah. So that whole little grab bag of little if then, if you will, I mean, that's pretty powerful stuff. And yet, as you say, they're not going to change. At least that's the outlook.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, was it Indian Point nuclear plant outside of New York City? I mean, that's a huge thing to try to replace that level of reliable power that runs like 17 out of 18 months, you know, at a time. And to try to replace it with some gas, but I guess really no one can, you know, the economics of gas plants aren't that great. Maybe in the Northeast, you know, they are, but the plan is to replace it obviously with less reliable stuff. And that's a dangerous plan, you know, to replace it with windmills and the same thing with Everett. I think you guys talked about on a podcast a while ago, the gas power plant there, and then trying to take the LNG away with it because, you know, they go together. Well, they still need the LNG to come into Everett, whether they have, well, I think it's Mystic or whatever it is. And so a real lack of just foresight. You know, why, if I was thinking about what I'd reckon for my clients, if my client were the East Coast and a consumer, I'd be like, don't do that. Let's come up with a better physical solution. And there's a lot of times, you know, especially for consumers, the derivative solutions are so expensive and can be so, you know, just put you at such a comparative disadvantage when prices go low that, you know, physical strategy is often superior. But they're not, you know, yeah, it's interesting. And the path they're headed down, and it just doesn't seem, I don't see it right now. I don't see them reversing course, any state. And where I mentioned, you know, all the way from, yeah, I guess, Virginia up, and then certainly the whole West Coast, there's no taste for pipelines or power plants or storage. So
I think there's a certain pain point that could drive a lot of that too, where like Europe is seeing right now with, you know, their largest solar panel producer now coming to the US just this week. Part of that, like their steel industry, and like so much of their manufacturing, is due to power prices and inherently natural gas prices. And so as you add more renewables, that creates that volatility. And so, you know, I think long-term, we can see some opportunities for those things, like a geothermal, like a nuclear, but especially in the US, the regulatory side of that is much longer. The technology is still developing. And so in between now and then, whenever then is, you're getting calls for peak oil, peak renewable first grid policies, things like this that seem to simplify it to a point that is dangerous for the U.S. economy, U.S. energy security, and potentially try and drive outsourcing of our energy security to unstable regions like Africa, the DRC, and China's and Asia at large. Their ownership of the supply chains for these technologies presents a real risk. And so it does seem a little bit short-sighted, especially in the near term.
One question from me on a little bit more of the near term pricing outlook, you know, and it's interesting, Matt, you referenced kind of the mid 2000s. We were in a pretty different supply regime, sort of commodity substitution regime. Well, today when gas drops like it has recently and it tries to find kind of a floor, how has it changed in terms of the amount of coal to gas substitution that can take place? Like, it strikes me that by retiring coal plants over the last 10 years, that floor, I don't know if it's softer, but it just can't be the shock absorber it once was. And then kind of part of that question is also, I don't know how many of the cold plants you can turn off once it gets hot, right? So I don't know how much substitution actually occurs. I guess the broader question is, we change the generation mix, which I think changes the trajectory of gas price and both on the downside and then also on the upside, right? I mean, there's nothing on the upside to sort of turn demand off. Any comments on that and what that means for, you know, maybe the next 3 to 6 months until we get to October?
I mean, it was an extraordinarily mild end to the winter, but we went right through all of the switching levels like a knife through butter. They weren't even there. And so we just went right down to shut-in economics, right? And that's what's kind of balanced the market, which is really incredible. If you think about when we did it in 2013-14, there was a lot more, in 2012, there was a lot more coal that we could switch off and kind of create some demand. That was also an incredibly mild end to the winter. And then I think that was the year that you had the large, for some engineering reason, the large storage facilities in Appalachia, like TECO and Dominion, et cetera, allowed people to keep more gas in the ground. And they're not able to do that this year. So ironically, you know, there's room in storage, but you have to empty the caverns every year, again, for engineering reasons and integrity reasons. And so the gas in storage has to come out to some minimum level. And so to balance the system, we had to shut the gas in. And to shut the gas in, that's around a dollar. You shut about $1.35. You know, we experienced this year, you shut in about 5% of production that is pretty economic. Some people just have variable costs that are that high. If you think about 5% of the 100 BCF got shut in, that's about what happened. And we saw a lot of little, all kinds of different sized producers shut things in and just like, well, I'm not going to, you know, cost me $1.35 to produce it. I'm not going to do that and sell it for $1.10. So we saw quite a bit of that. And so that's an interesting kind of nugget and data point to the downside. But I agree with you. There isn't as much coal to gas switching as there was. There are so more few coal plants. They're going to run in the summer. That you can, there's not a lot of flexibility there when it's hot. Everything's just kind of going to run, right? And then to the other side, I think that's a good point. You know, we can't turn all this coal on at $6 or whatever like we used to think we could. And save the market and balance the market like we did in 2013, 2014. So the next stop is, well, there's a lot of industrials that don't want to pay $20 for their gas. But I mean, the next stop is LNG. And that's a big switch. And that's kind of an interesting thing. Like, yeah, we're in trouble, but as long as global prices are kind of low, the target is near, it's not that big of a deal for us to go to $10 for a couple of months to solve a problem. It is a big deal to go to 100. And I think that's what we worry about is if, we're going to go seek this target of $10 to turn off US gas in Europe and Asia. Like, no, I want that. Now it's 20, you know? And so everyone feared in 2022, we're going to get in this race of who demands the LNG the hardest. And I think, it's interesting, like the invisible hand still works and it's wonderful. And that's what I love about the energy business, especially natural gas, you know, like price mechanism. She said we need to build a lot of storage in the mid-2000s. We built a lot of storage. Spread gets wide between, you know, North Louisiana and South Louisiana. We build a bunch of pipelines, you know, just perfect, beautiful, low prices, you know, a stable environment. It gets in trouble where the invisible hand can't work. And then it's told, no, you have to build this kind of generation or you can't build a pipeline here. And then we get all these weird, you know, kind of dislocations. And I think the question going forward is like, to Maynard's point earlier about the middle of the U.S. being a place where you could build, maybe you could build power plants if they're economic, they probably aren't. You can build factories. Energy prices are stable and cheap. The invisible hand kind of works in some places, and it's not allowed to work in other places. And I think that's the big question going forward everywhere. You know, are we going to rely on that to solve the problems, or are we going to rely on some kind of hybrid mix of things? And I think I mentioned to you when we talked, like it feels like it's a good time to be a command and control economy. Because we can't seem to come up with really good solutions because we're such a hybridized, we've got this pricing mechanism trying to solve things, and then we have all these rules that we can't solve the problem. And so the Chinese seem to be at least acting more rationally, like building the all of the above approach, all of the above approach to generation, building a lot of coal, building a lot of nuclear, making sure they have reliability, number one.
That point, Matt, that you just made, that might have to be our tagline for today because it's so counterintuitive that it's a good time to be a command and control economy. But if someone was sitting in Washington, D.C. and watching all of this from a price, reliability, bottleneck, security of supply type mentality, they would probably, to your point, just kind of put the edict down. Hey, California, we need these gas pipelines. We need these gas plants. New England, same thing. And I'm just making it up as I go. But hey, Jones Act's exception on some LNG that can go from port to port within the U.S. Like, here are the 10 things we're going to do to speed up construction, reduce volatility, you know, add some storage. You know, that's what you're talking about, just to kind of put words in your mouth, I think.
Yeah. I mean, a national energy policy that has as its goal, you know, stable prices, affordable energy for all, that kind of policy. And then, you know, now the issue is weaving in the CO2, obviously, reduction into that is, you know, those are two things that are often at odds with each other. And we just have to find, how do we, you know, if that is indeed what we need to do, well, what's, you know, I think this is kind of one of your whole theses. It's like, how do we do that responsibly and slowly and take our time and not just rush in there like, oh my God, let's build a bunch of windmills and see what happens. Let's build a bunch of solar over here and see what happens. You know, it's being a little bit more thoughtful and methodical about it, but it doesn't seem to be our MO lately.
Well, as you're pointing out, there's not systemic thinking about it. Like, what are we doing? There's just things happening, and they're happening area by area and state by state. Alex, maybe this is some information you have, or Matt, maybe you have it, but just, we were talking about ERCOT power prices and those spikes. And then you were talking about, you know, where it sits normally. Do you have a feel for dollars per megawatt hour around the country and what is happening in places in terms of, guys, we've had this whole conversation. We haven't even talked about power really as much as we've talked about natural gas. But what would you tell us about what power prices are doing around the country, various jurisdictions?
You know, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but the theme that you can kind of take across the U.S. is renewable hotspots, generally more volatility, especially for people that aren't going to be investing, to Matt's point, in pipelines, all the midstream and upstream components of the industry. And then where that translates, I think, kind of the point that Matt was getting to there, and I think the difference between the China-U.S. situation and why this is relevant to U.S. policymaking for power is this hierarchy of energy needs. I know Arjun talks about their Veriten quite a bit, but really, how do we get the availability, affordability, reliability, and security? These are the hierarchy of energy needs to drive economic outcomes. And to compare energy systems, that's kind of the system that, you know, we can use internally, but also I think from a policymaking perspective, if something does not meet that hierarchy, we cannot use it to replace a system that does replace the hierarchy. And so for natural gas, it's reliable generation. We can scale it. It's affordable. All of these attributes are met with natural gas. The same cannot be said with a renewable. And so, you know, I can go in and look at, I think this is a good opportunity to look at the ERCOT eclipse day, and we can kind of look at some of those figures like we're discussing.
Yeah, from a consumer perspective, you know, I think just looking at retail prices, you know, let's just call it 10 cents in Texas and 20 cents in California and Massachusetts kilowatt. So, you know, kind of double, I think, is a good rule of thumb, you know, on the islands, if you will.
That their power prices are roughly double.
Yeah, retail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when we take a look here at the you know, last April 8th eclipse, this is the path of total obscurity right here. And so the really interesting takeaway that we have when we look at Texas's system, we at first contact, so first moon touching the sun at 1219, we're hitting peak solar generation. of just under 14,000 megawatts, and that's instantaneous generation. And so then that peak obscurity, full eclipse at 1:36 p.m., we're hitting 800 megawatts. And so that change right there has to come from somewhere. And where does it come from? It comes from natural gas. And when we have some of these policy discussions that are hindering development of the natural gas industry while also creating systems that require the natural gas industry, I think that's where we're getting this mismatch that presents real significant risks to consumers, producers, and the U.S. energy security. I think that's kind of the real takeaway from taking this small example from one day across the wide grid. You're getting 9,000 megawatts of natural gas coming online. You're getting coal-fired generation coming online. And this little bump that you see at the bottom here in maroon is your power storage system. So that's the batteries that are typically proposed as the way that we'll phase out our fossil fuel use or traditional energy use. And while impressive, that is not going to meet the needs of just even a Texas grid. And so when we see that, we can also take a look at, you know, the daily variation by generation source. And gas, this variability right here, is happening because it has to accommodate the variability in wind and solar. And so I think the conversation of the hierarchy of energy needs, I think is a good direction for policymaking going forward, and hopefully our U.S. energy security strategy going forward, because this differs from China quite a bit. And, you know, once again, that's the effect on prices.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it seems like if thinking back to Uri, and just that was just a colossal screw up by everybody. And I think we kind of fixed it. You know, the grid's not so broken that we can't like, okay, coal's going to run in February now. We're gonna you know, fortify the gas gathering, processing, and, you know, generation system. We're gonna weatherize it a little bit, like, you know, so it's not beyond repair. But, you know, the more renewables you add to it, the more difficult it becomes to balance. You know, and you know, ramping things up and down. I think the really scary thing about this scenario, though, is talking about converting the whole transportation fleet to electricity. That's a completely different animal. You know, we basically, I think we would roughly have to double the amount of natural gas generation. If you did it with a bunch of solar and wind as well, you'd have to double the amount of transportation kind of around the US. And so, and it's the same thing. I think you guys had a podcast earlier that was about the AI demand. So any of these extraneous kind of maybe unexpected or self-inflicted boosts in power demand really are going to strain the electrical grid beyond what I think people can imagine.
Matt, when you're dealing with customers who are trying to manage this volatility in their costs, so on the consumer side, One question is, do they tend to be, are more of your customers increasingly on the East Coast or the West Coast where these issues might be larger? That's one question. The other side of it is, do you find producers are adding more and more people and more sophistication to their efforts to manage this volatility, you know, just given all these forces at work?
Yeah, I think for years, there's been a focus for consumers who are located in the Northeast or in California. They know they've got some real risk to the upside, and they've been much more careful about how they buy their gas. Mm-hmm. And make sure it's kind of, you know, fixed to a NYMEX price, and then they can hedge with some NYMEX and know what their costs are going to be. In the Midwest and the Southeast, I mean, before 2022 summer, a lot of our clients would just kind of take the price that they got, and it was so close to the Henry Hub, they didn't need to worry about, you know, any kind of basis dislocation. But over the last 3 years, we've seen, you know, in the summer of 22, all these Southeast basis locations went $5 over Henry Hub. That was a big surprise in a market that used to be plus or minus a nickel. So we're seeing a shift, a much more focus on, you know, I'd say having a much more disciplined approach to hedging every location around the country, much more interest in covering basis, even in Oklahoma or Arkansas or Northern Louisiana or, you know, Florida for sure. And in the Midwest and in the Rocky Mountains, you know, what was the last winter, one of the Northwest Pipeline Rocky Mountains indexed $50, you know, and that was just a cataclysmic event for some consumers. And a lot of them, you know, consumers, maybe the gas is, maybe it's 3% of their cost structure, 5%. And they're like, okay, so, you know, $3, $7, whatever. When it goes to 50, you know, that gets their attention. That can ruin their year, right? And so, so yes, way more attention from our consuming clients on running a more disciplined hedge book and trying to understand these kinds of instruments they never even had to deal with before and think through it. You know, and it takes a lot of expertise. I mean, I think it's good. I think it's a good thing for us. We're full of people who've spent their lives running very disciplined hedge books or, you know, producer hedge books, or trading strategies. So it's very hard to hire that expertise. It's hard to find people that understand, you know, the kind of this esoteric space and to manage it. And then also to look forward and have a plan. That's probably the hardest thing to get.
Yeah, Matt and Alex, the one, you know, I want to go back to the AI. You talked about that a little bit. Obviously, most people realize it's going to explode. The demand is just going to be substantial over the next 5, 6, 7 years. And one of the things that you've pointed out in one of your pieces is that the AI company, you know, the tech companies are obviously going after the sustainability as their primary source. And basically reliability and affordability is really not important at this point in time. And it seems like that could be distorting the market because some of these contracts, you know, some of these things that they're buying, they've got to be paying higher prices just to have that, you know, with these nuke facilities. And I guess my question is like, it's all about numbers, right? I mean, there's only so much, you know, so much generation that's going to be built over the next 4 or 5 years that's going to be clean or sustainable, whatever the case may be. At what point do you think these tech companies say, you know what, our primary goal shouldn't be sustainability. It also should be affordability and reliability. Do you see them there yet? Or is it maybe a year or 2 years down the road that they're like, okay, we've got to go to gas generation. All of the above is more important. Volatility of our pricing is more important.
I think that's returning to the market-driven dynamics that, like Matt talks about, the invisible hand. At some point, it's just going to force them to accommodate the power demand needs. If they want to go down the AI power AI route for consumers, they need the AI power capacity for data centers that need steady state, just stable, reliable load generation. And, you know, you see Google exploring some alternatives like load shifting. So if they're going to go down this path of, okay, we want to do only renewable energy or renewable power generation, then we can attempt to put our data centers in locations where if we lose output in one region, we can send our operations to another region. But that also, if you're going outside the US, brings the concerns from a policy perspective of what are you doing with that data? If you're having a facility in Saudi Arabia with, you know, US data, that presents some troubling takeaways for everybody. And so I think ultimately, you'll see more people doing like what Amazon did with Talon, up in Pennsylvania and looking for these opportunities to get nuclear. But at some point you're running out of those units. And at some point, I think, especially until those facilities are, from a regulatory perspective, just a little bit easier to produce and to, from a timeline perspective, a little bit closer to what China is able to do these days. I think the balance of that comes to something like natural gas.
Hey guys, given what's gone on at Waha, you've had some pretty bad prints, you know, in the last, call it 6 weeks or so. What would you tell a Permian producer to do about gas?
You know, hopefully they have enough hedges here in 24, or gas is a small enough percentage, especially in the Permian, that they don't really have to worry about zero revenue from gas. I mean, they have to worry about it, but now when it starts going -$1, -$2, that gets pretty scary. And you know, that you're literally paying to get rid of your gas. In the longer term, I think the good news for the Permian producer who wants to make sure they get positive value for their gas is, you know, the gas basis in 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, you know, it came all the way into the 60s, 60 cents backed. Maybe it's closer to 80 now today. But when you pair that with NYMEX at $4, you can get, let's say, half your gas in Waha, hedged at 320 for 4 years. I know that some people have some, you know, ideas that it's going to, you know, there'll be volatility only to the upside. But I think the important thing with, especially with a gas only producer, is you, when you get the opportunity to get, let's say, half your book hedged at $4, if that's the number that you need, you should take advantage of it and let the other half run, especially in the Permian where you have a lot of oil. We really advise our Permian producers, like, let's just try not to muck up the gas too bad. And when you get a chance to hedge oil in the 80s or 90s, like, we want to do that too. So, it's one of those things that, and there's been a number of examples of this over the last 20 years where everyone concludes, oh, it's solved, we got enough takeaway, you know, and then lo and behold, some maintenance happens and boom, we're trading negative $2 again. And Permian's just like that. And I expect it to continue to be like that. And I think part of the problem is that really California should be taking more gas from them, but that's just never going to happen. So it's kind of blocked in there, waiting for Mexico to get its stuff together, waiting for South Texas to be able to take enough of it. I think it's a good idea to kind of look at that long-term hedge for some percent of the book for Permian producers for gas.
Matt, you mentioned Mexico. That's something we talk about a little bit. It's kind of interesting. If you, the Mexico is the next China type discussion, that's been around for a while, but it does seem like it would be a real good place to do a lot of manufacturing and bring it to the U.S. Any comments on what you're seeing U.S. gas going to Mexico, those volumes, that activity? Is that picking up? What do you think about Mexico?
Yeah, it's been, I think it was kind of increasing by a quarter BCF a day per year for a long time. And it's really kind of picked up the last few years.
It's the single largest purchaser of U.S. gas.
I think now we export more, correct me if I'm wrong, Alex, we export more to Mexico than we import from Canada, which is quite a shift, you know? And then if you think about, it'd be tremendous if Mexico could get their act together and have an industrial policy and have a, you know, pro-growth, pro-free market government. I think everyone's thought that since NAFTA, you know, look at the potential down there. It's been a huge disappointment. But I think them building out the LNG facilities, that's going to be good for, you know, takeaway into Mexico. And then, they're slowly, they've methodically built these pipelines crossing the border and getting into central Mexico. And it's just taken, like a lot of things in Mexico, it's just taken a little more time to bring these power plants and industrial areas online, but it's slowly going to keep happening. I just don't expect it. I don't know. I don't expect some kind of economic revolution to come out of there and then really to flip it into high gear.
So guys, as you think about all of this stuff we're talking about, volatility in gas prices and all the components of that, and then volatility in power prices, and then an outlook that seems to be where we're not focused enough on this stuff, and even if we were, it's hard to solve because there's a lot of jurisdictions and you got to get a lot of people on board, and then there's going to be a lot of trade-offs. So when you think about that picture and you think about Mobius over the next 10 years, are you guys just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger because there's just more and more volatility? Like, what is the Mobius outlook? Because you manage volatility and it looks like the quantity of it is going up, not down.
Yeah, I mean, we really have had really strong growth in, you know, our business since COVID, like I said, since the natural gas market came back to life. And then with this thing, you know, happening in the UK and Russia, I mean, it just heightens everyone's awareness that they really need professional management of their hedge program. And if they don't have a hedge program, they probably need one. If they don't know what an option is or a put option or a call option, they probably need to figure that out and start using them in a volatile environment, you know, you have to have an actively managed hedge book, but you have to have someone watching it and managing it that knows when a great opportunity comes along. Because even a consumer with it, like in 2022, with very deep in the money hedges, they bought some gas at 250 and we went and traded 9 and we're like, hey, you can do some things here to make sure this derivative book never goes negative. always will pay you $70 million. It'll cost you $5 million. Do you want to do it? We don't want to, you know, we don't want to, you know, optimize the hedge book, for example. And so I think that kind of, and now, you know, they went through some, you know, this last winter, let's say some of them like, okay, now these are negative. Okay, let's end the hedge program. You know, so everyone has to, I think, up the level of sophistication and understand the risk management techniques and have a deep, pretty, really deep experience. I mean, I think it takes more than 10 years of doing this to really understand what you're doing and to be able to size up what the right moves are.
Matt, do you notice the difference between public companies and private companies in their approach to all this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, from the producer side, I just think the public companies, obviously they want to have something very systematic and rigid and way, you know, I would say way over documented and not flexible enough. And probably in general, you know, might, you know, make some decisions that are more, to keep it in the policy rather than this is a great economic opportunity. Also, I think the publics aren't as willing or able to open up upside and participate to the upside even more when they can. Publics also, I think, in general, though, however, they try to participate in the upside by having a very minimal hedge right now, at least. I mean, that's kind of the thing right now we're seeing. Like the hedge ratios are very low. And yeah, it's interesting, you know, I think there's much more from the public space also trying to understand where the market is going and trying to set their book up to participate to the upside more so than a private who's like, hey, the price is pretty high. Let me take some chips off the table here.
Do you find it interesting? Just last question. We're all energy nerds. We can't help ourselves here, Matt, but as you know, we've had all these upstream mergers. And those upstream mergers make bigger companies that could afford bigger staffs, bigger teams, you know, maybe more risk-taking. So what do you see as companies get bigger, and we're probably going to see more of it, as companies get bigger in the upstream space, how does it tend to affect their philosophy around these risks / these opportunities?
Yeah, I think that they hedge less. You know, and I think that the heavy, especially right now, you know, the more oil mix you have in your revenue stream, the more you've gotten away with not hedging the oil or the gas and then getting rewarded for it by getting acquired. It seems like the people who are the least hedged are the ones getting acquired. So, I think it will be a headwind for production growth. The larger the company is that owns these assets. Because they have more alternatives to invest in different projects around the world. Like, let's say, would you rather build a refinery somewhere or, you know, drill for gas in Oklahoma? I'd probably build the refinery with, you know, $30 crack spreads. So probably less hedge activity out of those guys. I don't think it'll affect the derivative market that much. I just think that they're not going to hedge as much. And I think that, I think it probably will slow down production a little bit.
Well, Matt and Alex, we really appreciate the discussion today. As you can tell, there's just so much under the hood here. We could have gone, this is one of those shows that's a candidate for a multi-hour discussion.
Good. Let's do it again.
Well, we appreciate our friendship with you. And, you know, with the volatility on the horizon, we will be bugging you frequently. So thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thanks for having us on.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, everybody.